This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. Most people are pretty particular about how they present themselves to the world, how they frame themselves. But the reality is, we're all a little crooked, a little off, askew, bless you. And that's fine. That's human. What bothers me are the people who aren't just a little off, but clearly warped, dangerously so, and not even pretending to straighten themselves out. They have no structure, no boundaries, no frame. They don't care to be on the level. And many of us reach, bend over backwards even, to help frame them. He's rough, but he's a straight shooter. Okay, so being a straight shooter gives you license to be an asshole? Got it? You just have to get to know her better. Uh-huh. I don't think so. That's actually the problem. I've been getting to know her. But okay, we're framing, adjusting. For them, I get that. Decent people adjust themselves for the sake of others. Sure, they may lie a little, straighten a picture here, tilt a mirror there, trying to present something acceptable. But what most of us truly want is to be seen, to see others, and to exist together in something resembling a stable society. But the ones who can't be bothered, they're unframed forgeries. They sell themselves as free spirits when really they're just selfish. Out to take what they can. Staying quiet, staying hidden, carefully crafting false profiles designed to lure you in. They are the quiet fishermen, the patient hunters of human beings, privately mounting their trophies in the dark corners of their minds. No trespassing. Nothing to see here. Nothing to present. They don't frame themselves. Monsters like Arthur Shawcross, the Genesee River Killer, the Rochester Strangler, the Killer Whale. They frame only one thing. Us. Welcome to Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. The work of art. Shawcross. Arthur John Shawcross was born 2 months premature on June the 6th of 1945 in Kittery, Maine, as the first of four children to Arthur Roy Shawcross and his mom Elizabeth Bessie Shawcross. The family moved to Watertown, New York when he was young. Shawcross struggled academically, falling two grades behind, and was bullied for being odd, speaking in baby talk he did, and he exhibited unusual behavior. He had an IQ between 86 and 92 and suffered multiple head injuries as a child, including being hit with a discus and falling from a ladder. Two separate incidents, though I like to imagine them as one. He was a chronic bedwetter into his mid-teens and was preoccupied with sex from an early age. By 7 years old, he was masturbating frequently and soon engaged in oral sex with both males and females, as well as engaging in bestiality, admitting to having killed a chicken once after having had intercourse with it, and it would have been a mercy had he simply choked that chicken, but alas, he was a foul child. Shawcross claimed extensive childhood abuse. That included his mother inserting a broom handle into his anus while performing oral sex on him at the age of 7. Though his mother later vehemently denied this. I mean, who wouldn't? I don't believe it, but who knows? He also alleged sexual assault by an aunt and expressed a desire for a sexual relationship with his younger sister. At age 9, it was discovered that his father had another family in Australia, which upset his mother greatly. Shawcross claimed that she took out her frustrations on him, though it sounded to me like she was already cleaning his clock. You know what I mean? I'll tell you what I think. I think that Shawcross was completely full of shit, even after allegedly having a broom handle shoved in and out of his ass. I'll keep entertaining his tales, though, because they're, well, I shouldn't say entertaining. One day on his way home from school, a man picked him up, he says, held a knife to his throat, and performed fellatio on him, then sodomized Shawcross when the little boy couldn't orgasm due to fear. Imagine being told to orgasm by a dude with a knife to your throat while he's blowing you, or else he's going to sodomize you. That's fucked up. I don't think I could do it. I mean, how much time did he give him? I wonder. Anyways, from then on, Shawcross reportedly couldn't I'm going to try my best not to be fucked up about all this. It's super fucked up, so it's tough when you're in the realm. From then on, Shawcross reportedly couldn't achieve orgasm without pain involved. He grew into a violent teenager, beating neighborhood kids up, breaking into homes, stealing from businesses, and setting fires. He was diagnosed with pyrophilia, and that's sexual arousal from fire starting. He faked injuries for attention and spent much time fishing alone. Shawcross was what one might write off as a big dope, a literal dickhead. His chin kind of sunk into his thick neck, making him look like a big dick. But he was shrewd, mean, and motivated to get back at the world, planning for it as he seemed to peacefully fish the city's rivers. He dropped out of high school in 1960 to commit arsons and burglaries, leading to his first incarceration. In April of 1967, at age 21, he was drafted into the U.S. Army. He managed to marry a girl he knocked up, but claimed to forget he'd done that after serving. When he got back from Vietnam, he divorced that wife, Sarah, with whom he had a son, whom he gave up the rights to. And this baby might have been the cause of Art's amnesia. He served with the 4th Supply and Transport Company in Vietnam from 1968 to 1969 as a supply specialist, not in combat. Despite this, he fabricated horrific war stories, claiming he captured, tortured, raped, and murdered Vietnamese women, shot an 11-year-old girl, beheaded victims and displayed their heads on poles, and engaged in cannibalism. Army records confirm no combat, no Purple Heart, no bravery awards, no exposure to Agent Orange like he'd later claim. He was honorably discharged in April of 1969 at the age of 23. After discharge, he married his second wife, Linda, and moved to Clayton, New York. Their marriage deteriorated as he committed more arsons and burglaries, leading to a 5-year sentence at Attica and Auburn prisons. He was released in early October 1971 after 22 months, partly for rescuing a guard during a riot, which I find interesting. Shawcross is a clear bullshitter, but then here we have him doing things that would sound like BS coming from him. This to say, he could surprise you, especially if you mistook him for some dopey dickhead who simply liked to fish peacefully by the Genesee River. I mean, he was what crude people of the time would refer to as a, quote, big retard. So after his early release from prison for saving the life of a guard, Shawcross returned to Watertown, New York, and worked for the Public Works Department. Then he married his third wife, Penny. A year later, in the spring of 72, Arthur Shawcross's first known murders occurred in Watertown. This is when the penny dropped. The work of Art Shawcross would start with a beginner's course. He targeted children. 10-year-old Jack Owen Blake was the sixth born of eight children, and the only one with a different father due to his mother's affair with a man only known as Bob. And that was my dad's name, a name you don't hear much anymore. What should we name him, honey? What about Bob? It's a good movie. Jack grew up quickly. He was mischievous, but never in serious trouble. He respected his mother and was the only child his father spared violence to. There was something, he said, that was different about that boy, Jack. Yeah, man, he's not your kid. Jack had blonde hair, freckles, big ears, a pug nose, and a limp. He prided himself on looking after his younger brother, little Pete. His dad's name was Pete, so dad was Big Pete. At age 10, his mother revealed Jack's true paternity, saying, quote, "Well, I wanted you to know about your bloodline, and I want you to always remember that you have a father that has some class, unlike this one." Jack kept his knowledge of this to himself, not wanting to fuck up the family dynamic that was, pretty fucked up already. In spring of 1972, Jack told his mother about a stranger, Shawcross, then 26, 6 foot tall, wiry with muscular arms, who took him and little Pete fishing without permission. She forbade the boys to have further contact with Shawcross. Days later, 10-year-old Jack brought Shawcross home after selling him worms. He'd go dig up some worms, what they call them, night crawlers at the time, and sell them to Shawcross down by the Genesee River. He brings Shawcross home, saying, "Hey, Mom, this is my new friend," fucking 26 years old, big fucking dickhead. She again warned her boy and told the strange man named Shawcross to go away. The boys from there kept their interactions with the big fisherman secret from Mom. One day, they followed Shawcross to the river, where he horsed around with them and shoved leaves down their pants. And he was grabbing their dicks when he did that. On May 7th, 1972, their father, Big Pete, promised to take the boys fishing, but got stinking drunk instead. Mom sent the boys out to play, telling them to return for dinner, telling them their father was incapacitated. It was bingo night, which Jack loved. Hours after being sent out to play so that Mom could take the beating by herself, a witness at a motel saw Shawcross emerge from the woods, breathing hard, boots muddy, carrying a fishing rod. He later claimed to have been in the area that was a distance from his regular fishing spot, visiting relatives. "Hey guys, I'm here." "Why? Your boots are all muddy and you got a fishing pole." "I'm here." Jack missed dinner and bingo. His mother suspected that Shawcross was the reason for this. She eventually found him at the fishing spot and confronted him, but he denied involvement. No one had seen him and the boy together that day. Shawcross later confessed that he had lured Jack to the woods, stripped him, then chased him, caught him, sexually assaulted the boy, beat, and then strangled him. He then removed Jack's heart and genitals with his fishing fillet knife, and then he ate those genitals and heart. This is a detail he later refused to discuss in 2003 interviews. Shawcross was a suspect at the time in the complete disappearance of young Jack Blake, but investigators lacked any evidence. Jack's body was found in October of 1972, after Shawcross led police to it as part of a deal following his capture for this next incomprehensible crime. Early September 1972, 8-year-old Karen Ann Hill lived in Rochester but was visiting Watertown over Labor Day weekend. Witnesses saw her on a bridge, alone climbing the railing of that bridge, and they saw Shawcross nearby leaving his bike to go talk to her. Returning from the bridge that no longer had a little girl on it, rather under it, Shawcross was seen speaking to a boy he knew, offering him ice cream while peering into a sewer grate, possibly checking for visibility of that girl's body. Shawcross carried the boy's groceries home for him, maybe feeling kind after having been so cruel. A fisherman found Karen, 8 years old, face down in Black River, covered in rocks. She had been strangled, raped, and sodomized. Probably post-mortem, he's known to do this later on. Mud, leaves, and debris were stuffed into her mouth and vagina. Shawcross was questioned after witnesses placed him near the bridge. After hours of interrogation, he asked, quote, "What's going to happen to me if I tell y'all something?" A plea bargain was soon arranged, and what a bargain it was. 2 for 1. Investigators offered a reduced charge of manslaughter for Karen in exchange for leading to Jack's body. He confessed, quote, "I must have done it, but I don't remember exactly what happened." Evidence for 10-year-old Jack was circumstantial. Shawcross was charged with manslaughter in the murder of 8-year-old Karen. He was not charged in the murder of Jack. He got 25 years at Greenhaven, and he'd serve much less than that. Shawcross struggled early in prison with fights and minor offenses. Inmates targeted him upon learning of his crimes. He became a model prisoner, and he earned early parole after undergoing psychiatric evaluations. Here are some of the key notes from those evaluations. Over the years, he spent imprisoned for brutally killing 2 children. In June of 1977, he was seen, and the psychiatrist deduced that Shawcross suffered from schizoid personality, low self-esteem, antisocial personality disorder, and psychosexual difficulties. In September of 79, he was seen again and deemed to have an abnormal character with psychosexual issues. In 1983, August, good contact with reality and control. Oh, he's improving. In August of 1985, 2 years later, the psychiatrist said that there appeared to be no emotional disturbance in Arthur Shawcross. In February of 1987, he appeared to be neat, cooperative, alert. He had a positive attitude. There was no perpetual disorder. He did have delusions, some mental illness, but seemed overall emotionally stable, but needed psychotherapy for emotional conflicts within him. Shawcross convinced evaluators of improvement, though his issues were unclear. He was paroled April 28, 1987, at the age of 41. After 14 years, 6 months served of his potential 25-year sentence for killing 2 little kids and raping them, and eating one, senior parole officer Robert T. Kent warned, quote, "At the risk of being overdramatic, the writer considers this man to be possibly the most dangerous individual to have been released to this community in many years," end quote. In prison, he became pen pals with Rose Marie Wally. They corresponded for 12 years and planned marriage upon his release. Post-release, Shawcross moved from town to town with his new love. He was forced out of each town by the community each time. They were outraged, and the police, who were let to be known of his prior conviction, let the community know that this guy is a real fucking danger, and they would force him out. It was hard for Shawcross to get any work done with the public all over him. Shawcross requested anonymity. "Please stop telling people who I am. It's ruining my life." The killer finally ended up in Rochester, New York's Hudson Avenue group home in October of 1987, just months after leaving prison and then being chased from apartments. The parole board informed only local police, but they did not give any criminal history to those police, aiding in Shawcross's anonymity going forward. This was Karen Hill, the 8-year-old who was brutally murdered here, her hometown. Remember, her family had only been visiting Watertown when she was plucked from her play off the side of a bridge by a troll who all but consumed her beneath it. He, of course, consumed the boy Jack some. And call me conservative, but I think if you rape, torture, and murder 2 little kids, I don't think you should be allowed back outside. But here he is, free and clear, finally. In Rochester, Shawcross skips his mandatory therapy and ignores curfew, as well as child proximity restrictions. Overworked officers reduced their frequency of check-ins on the recently released. They didn't even know how dangerous Shawcross was, thanks to him being protected from further torch and pitchfork mobs at his door. By mid-October 1987, he and Rose moved to 241 Alexander Street. He got a job at a food service company, this in Rochester. It was called G&J Guts. That's a good name. It suits him. He loves guts. He became a fixture, Shawcross did, of the area, biking around, always with his fishing rod, hanging off his back like a tail. Art was known to frequent Dunkin' Donuts and hang out with a bunch of fucking idiots there. You know, like, I shouldn't say too much about that. Art was known to frequent Dunkin' Donuts and seemed eager to help out others. You know these guys, they go and they hang out at the donut shop. Mostly good guys, but pretty plain. They just want to nurse a coffee for a while, get away from their wives, and talk a bit about politics, the weather. No one knew Shawcross. They knew he had a past, knew he had done jail time, but figured he was just on the mend as a human being. Because of his sadistic appetite, sex with his girl that he met in prison there suffered. He had erection issues. He turned to the avenues looking for prostitutes. He had an affair at one point with a woman named Clara Neal, using her light blue Dodge Omni for errands and to go and procure sex from sex workers. Her daughter Linda disliked Shawcross. He roughed up her brothers, bit a 14-year-old brother of hers' nipple, and sat on another until he couldn't breathe. He groped Loretta, that's Clara's other daughter, and he eyed her 3-year-old son, and who knows how often he shoved his hand down his pants. Linda, the daughter to Clara, whom he's seeing now, and Loretta, the other daughter, learned of his child murder somehow and urged their mother to leave him, but Clara refused to. None knew he had resumed killing by this point, a spree that would become known as the Rochester Murders. So after release for the murders of 2 children, Shawcross killed at least a dozen women, mostly prostitutes, drug addicts, homeless. From March 1988 to December of 1989, dumping many near the Genesee River, earning the nickname of the Genesee River Killer. He strangled most, mutilated some, posed bodies humiliatingly, for example, with their buttocks up, suggesting post-mortem sodomy. In 2003, he admitted slicing out and eating the vulva of 3 victims. He believed a 13th century cannibal spirit possessed him, driving his axe. Victims often had bite marks, lacerations, or debris stuffed in orifices, echoing earlier crimes with children. Many of his now victims were crack addicts, like Shawcross, though. Different types. He was into... Why would I write that? Shawcross is in the crack, but not the cocaine type. With the fucking asses in the air. He would pose his victims with their asses in the air. And he had sodomized them post-mortem. It was kind of his calling card. To have obviously sodomized corpses. Shawcross reminds me of some guy my dad used to hang out with. My grandpa? No, my grandpa was good looking. But talk of sex workers and crack use always makes me think fondly of my elders. And let's take a deep breath. For a sec, let's let it all melt away for a moment. Let me bask in my memories. Grandpa, Wild Bill, walking down the streets of Cabbage Town, Toronto, in his boxer shorts, looking for a fight, shouting out to a hooker, quote, ain't you worn that thing out yet? And her coming over and beating him with her purse, meaning it. Those are good times. In later years, me and my dad, Hardcore Bo, as he was known, walking those same streets in search of nothing but trouble. A fat crack rock placed in the pipe of a repurposed asthma inhaler. These are good memories for me. And how I relate to some of these victims when it comes to why they got so hooked into crack addiction around this time. A lot of these sex workers dead. You know, you got that big fat crack rock perched on the pipe of a repurposed asthma inhaler, perched on a bed of ashes above the pin-poked foil at eye level as you commit to take that hit. And the rock, it melts like a tiny glacier, yielding to the flick of your Bic, converted to billowing sweet smoke that arrives to shrink your thoughts down to nothing. Like rotten candy, it runs down your spine and straightens you out for maybe 7, maybe 15 minutes, if you're lucky. Drugs. That's the name of my poem here. Drugs. I've been around them a bit. The scene, as they say. I understand why they're so popular. It's simple for people who have suffered to understand. They make you feel good. And it doesn't matter for how long. If you were drowning, you know, as a straight person who doesn't understand this shit, if you were drowning, being pulled under by life, how much would you pay and how often for a hit of fresh air? A lot of us have problems that don't go away. Not tomorrow, not next week. So we fix. For the record, I'm clean, but it took one hell of a shower. Arthur Shawcross got his fix too. Only his wasn't chemical. His involved killing women, what we're supposed to call sex workers today. They used to be called hookers, because they hook you in, right? Like my dear old grandfather used to say, he'd say, call me an asshole, call me a son of a bitch, call me whatever you want, just don't call me late for dinner. And dinner was drugs. But for Shawcross, dinner was death. Dottie Blackburn, 27 years old, was a hooker. Sorry, a proud sex worker, cocaine addict, mother of three, including a six-month-old baby. She had lunch with her sister Kathy on March 14, 1988, then dropped off her baby, got her hard hat, and went to work as a sex worker on Rochester, Saratoga Street. Dottie went missing sometime after 2 a.m., Her boyfriend, it was actually her pimp, but boyfriend, it was also her baby's father, searched for Dottie to no avail before filing a report. Dottie's body was found frozen in Salmon Creek by a work crew, initially thought to be a mannequin she was. She was identified by her sister. She had been bitten multiple times. There was vaginal and clitoral lacerations. She had been strangled. There was no semen on the scene. And spoiler alert, that's because Shawcross couldn't bust a nut. He couldn't get off. It just was all something that he could jerk off about later, and he would return to scenes to jerk off. We'll get to that in a bit. And quickly here, I want to say I have the utmost respect for women who get into sex work. I like to fuck around with it because I've had friends in sex work historically, you know, 20 years ago when I was like on the street myself. And it's just so ridiculous to me to think that you need to be careful on how you talk about those people. They're tough as shit. They don't give a fuck. I've said this before. They don't care. The only thing they care about is not catching a weird dick in a bush. They don't give a fuck about how you talk about them. Fuck, they know you talk about them. Like, it's a down and dirty situation. Should we start calling drug dealers fucking pharmaceutical adjacent procurers of... I don't know what the fuck. I don't even know how to end that. It's, come on. They're fucking hookers. And they're fine with it. At least the ones on the streets. I mean, maybe these ones who are behind a fucking camera and shit get all weird about it because they're safe. But goddamn, the ones who aren't safe, don't try to fucking save them by saying the right words about them. Go out there and give them $500 and don't make them suck your dick. Do that. So from Shawcross's later account, what happened was he was driving in Lyell, this is in Rochester, and she flagged him down asking for a date. He wanted a mutual oral. She bit his penis while that was happening and he was bleeding. He bit her vagina in response. Probably he bit her vagina first, I would guess. And then he flipped her around and strangled her unconscious. And then he drove to Northampton Park Bridge, smacked her back to life. then raped her, choked her for 10 more minutes, killed her in this choking incident, dumped the bitch, those are his words, face down in a creek, discarded her shoes, socks, and coat in the trash, cleaned his car, which was his girl's car, this Omni, this blue Omni, and then he went and got coffee at the Dunkin' Donuts with the boys. Less than a month later, on April the 11th, Shawcross was visited by an official to be evaluated on his progress with integrating back into society. This evaluator said there was no reoccurrence of impulses and no further therapy needed. Anna Marie Steffen, 28 years old, she disappeared July 9th, 1988, was found September the 11th. She had been arrested July 8th of 88 for prostitution, but was brought to hospital on account of her being malnourished. She weighed 95 pounds. She was 8 months pregnant, dilated. She was in poor health. She left the hospital without anybody knowing. The problem with Anna Marie stemmed back to 1980 when she'd been 20 and caring for her sister with spina bifida. Her sister died in 80, and that devastated Anna Marie. Here in 88, you know, showing signs of all that devastation. Anna Marie had married, had two kids, but drugs dominated. She had been last seen soliciting the area of Lyell in Rochester. Friends thought she likely birthed privately and died somewhere doing that, or had jumped off a bridge because she had threatened to do so. Her body was found decomposed in the Genesee River Gorge by a bottle collector. He saw a leg hanging from a garbage bag under trees and broken asphalt. A bottle collector is just some guy who doesn't want to work and just picks up empties, if you don't know. My dad's coming up once again here. Her hair was ripped out. Her eyes were gone. Her skin was rotting. The cause of death, from the coroner's report, was probable asphyxia. Neck tissue had decayed more so than the rest of the body. Identification was made possible via clay facial reconstruction. Think Unsolved Mysteries. They often did these clay facial reconstructions. Dental records were used as well. And her eventual identification came from her father calling into investigators after the media had shown his daughter Anna Marie's reconstruction photo on television. I'm going to go to Shawcross's account here once again. He said he was walking Lake Avenue to Princess Restaurant when he met Anna Marie and asked her for a date. A date meaning, you know, I'm going to pay you for sex. They went behind YMCA to the Driving Park Bridge Field. They had oral, he received oral, then had intercourse with Anna Marie. Then some kids kind of walked up around their vehicle, and Anna Marie tried to dress herself and leave. He pinned her at this point and held her down on the floor of the vehicle. He feared parole violation because they're around kids here, and the kids see him and mark the car and run off saying that there's some people having sex around kids. That's going to violate his parole. Anna Marie threatened to scream. He panicked, he says, and then he strangled her. And then he rolled her behind a bush once the kids left. He claimed that violating parole was his main motivator in this murder. Of course, with his experience in the system, murder wasn't much of a big deal anyways. It was becoming something he just did. Like work. The work of art. Shawcross.
This isn't just a game. It's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Dorothy Keeler, 59. Disappeared July 29th, 1989. She was found October 21st, 1989. She was homeless. They call her a streets dweller. Ah, this part reminds me of my dad. I keep on involving myself. My dad had a girl cleaning his place before he died. She would clean it naked. She did that until she killed him. I gotta stop with that shit. I gotta stop digressing like that. It's just that sometimes a story, you know, it really hits close to home. Around the holidays, you start thinking about family, you know? Oh, and you just can't help yourself but talk about it a bit. Shawcross had hired Dorothy to clean his apartment, paying her $4 an hour. They started an affair. She cleaned his apartment naked, and they had lots of free sex. Lasted 2 months, this did, until he accused her of theft of laundry money he had given her. Art confronted the bitch, as he'd call her, at the fishing spot he frequented on the Genesee River after having had sex with her by the river. She threatened telling Rose, his partner, about their relationship. He hit her with a log. As a result, and then later behind a rotting tree where she then rotted. She was dead. He returned a month later, smelled that rot, then took another branch and cracked her skull open with it, and then threw her into the river. And the idea behind this was that maybe the fish would get after her quicker if she was all split open. There was no missing report, as she was homeless and kind of being off the street for a while and taken care of by Shawcross. She was kind of out of the periphery or the view of anybody on the streets. Bones of hers were found in a fetal position by fishermen. Her jeans were down to her bone bare thighs. Her shoes were found nearby on the river's edge. She had no head. The coroner could tell that this corpse had an old rib injury, had heel spurs, which are common in prostitutes. Blunt impacts were likely, they figured. A jail employee suggested that that corpse could be that of Dorothy Keeler, whom he hadn't seen for a while. She was known to come in and out of the jail. Street inquiries confirmed that she had disappeared from the streets in July. And don't blink, because you'll miss one. If you've ever seen an interview with Art Shawcross, you'll know he has a blinking problem. So don't you have one too? You got something in your eye there, Art? That's what you want to say to him when you see him blinking like that. You got something in your eye there, Art? Blood. From all this work. At least that's how Shawcross framed it. Patricia Patty Ives, 25. Disappeared September 29th, 1989. She was found October 27th of 1989. My ninth birthday. This is very nostalgic, this story. Patty was gentle, naive, started drugs at 16, dropped out of school. She was an exotic dancer at one point. She specialized in oral sex through glory holes. Holy fuck. She specialized in glory holes, giving oral sex through them. She was that kind of sex worker. Frequent jail stints she had for prostitution, drugs. There was many rehab attempts that failed for her. She was known as Crazy Patty. She was skeletal looking with needle marks, rumored to have AIDS. She was missing 2 weeks before her pimp, Ratface Billy, reported her as such. Her body was found by a boy retrieving a baseball behind Maplewood YMCA. Under cardboard, she'd been dead for weeks. Maggots were eating at her flesh. Her cause of death by the coroner, acute asphyxia. And I have a note here from a witness report that says at 7:30 p.m. on September 29th, she had walked with a white male who was on a bike with fishing rods sticking out of his back. He had parked the bike by a fence that she had walked through and then followed her through that hole. Art wasn't going to go fishing. He wasn't going on a date. He was going to work. June Stott, 30 years old, disappeared October 23rd, 1989. Her body was found a month later. She was shy, homeless, heard voices, slept in parks, doorways after her mother's death. She carried a pocket knife for fear of assault. She had thick glasses, a round face. She was full-figured. She lived with a man named Joseph in Chestnut Street rooming house. She was last seen at 9 a.m. having a beer alone at the Hotel Cadillac in Rochester. She missed her 4 p.m. meetup that day with her boyfriend, Joe. Joe assumed she found a new partner because he saw her with a pot-bellied man around 50 years old on a bike with fishing rods sticking out of the back. June's body was eventually found by a dog walker in a marsh amongst reeds and cattails, under an ice-encrusted carpet. Her foot was protruding from it. This guy can't seem to push the feet in. It's crazy because, I mean, usually he puts them over on their stomachs and props them up with the back end up for post-mortem sodomizing. But their feet keep on kicking out. Maybe they stretch out. Anyways, I don't want to keep on thinking about that. She was face down with her right leg bent out. Yeah, that makes sense. Her buttocks was elevated and asphyxiation was probable. She had been slashed from the breastbone to the crotch. Her genitals were missing. And a pocket knife was found nearby. No prints on it. There was also no semen found. Because we know Shawcross can't actually get off until he thinks about it later. This is a new dump site for Shawcross, about 7 miles downriver. He's hearing about his crimes in the news. He's become known now as the Genesee River Killer. In Shawcross's confession, he said about this killing that he saw her on a bench and then he picked her up and took her to Charlotte and bought her bread, chips, and soda. They parked on the beach and they walked the pier. They fed the ducks. They sat on a carpet. She asked him to teach her to make love. Then he undressed and she undressed. And it was a beautiful scene on the beach where he attempted to penetrate her but couldn't. She sat up and said, "Oh my God, I'm going to tell the police about what you're trying to do to me." And he's like, "What the fuck? You asked for this shit." So he panics and strangles her and then throws her clothes in the water and then sits talking to the body for a while. And then he covers it up some and goes home to his girlfriend. He's blinking the whole time he's telling this story. I mean, it's a sign. I'll talk about blinking. But a sign that you're thinking usually is blinking. A sign you're making something up could be that too. And a sign that you're nervous, right? Trying to collect yourself with your eyelids. Your eyes, as I mentioned many times before, are the window to your soul, but they're literally an attachment to your brain. And it's like you're kind of trying to close those thoughts off. He's just like blinking through talking about this. It makes no fucking sense. And either does his expression through all of this. Anyways, he returns days later to the body, finds it stiff, and drags it to a swamp, and he cuts the neck to the anus at that point, and then removes the vagina with his fucking fillet knife and takes some bites out of it. These are sick details. Shawcross wouldn't care to share them much later, but you can find them. So all that blinking he would do, I just talked about, but in the end, maybe it was just a way to fight off the memories. Like getting blasted by the sideways snowfall of a blizzard. In interviews, it seems that way. It's like, oh, I'm thinking about this. Fuck, I don't want to think about this. You know how it is? Sometimes things done in the heat of the moment seem cold and disgusting later. Perhaps that's what the blinking was all about. Or more likely, Shawcross was just fucking weird. Maria Welch, 22. Disappeared November 5th, 1989. She was found 2 months later in 1990, January 5th. She was 5'2", 100 pounds, had a light complexion, brown eyes, hair, tattoos, a unicorn on her forearm, a rose on her left arm, a marijuana leaf on her ankle, the letters L-O-V-E across her knuckles. Spell it backwards, evil. I'll show you, that's Eminem. So all this information is from the coroner. She had worked as a proud sex worker on the Lyell and Saratoga streets, this area of Rochester, with her roommate. On November 5th at midnight, a small blue hatchback containing a slim male in his 40s cruised by twice, and then that roommate was picked up. This is who we get this information from. She was returned safely, but then Maria, she found to be gone. It seemed that Shawcross was the only John in a blue car picking up girls. If you didn't catch that, two blue cars, two girls, one got the short straw of Shawcross. Maria was assumed to be working. There wasn't much of a search for her. Shawcross later led police to a wooded area near where he dumped June Stott. He brushed away some snow, and she was found bent over, her face down and shoved into the knees, and had been raped anally while dead. This is his calling card. Shaw crosses account here. He picked her up, he said, and parked at Mark's on the lake. This is a business, a restaurant. He parked behind that restaurant, put the heater on high. It was very cold. He gave her $30. They both undressed from the waist down. He asked her if she was on the rag. She said no. But then when they're having sex, he felt blood kind of dripping all over his nuts and then reached down and felt a tampon string. And he was like, what the fuck, you are on the rag? And she goes, go fuck yourself. And then he choked her unconscious and then tied her hands and feet with rope and then pulled her tampon out, stuffed it in her mouth. And she demanded to be untied. And that's when he mounted her and said, I love you, and kissed her. And then he strangled her to death. That's his account. Don't blame me. Next up, unfortunately, Frances Franny Brown, 22. She disappeared November the 11th, 1989. No, Remembrance Day, my son's birthday. Shout out. She was found November 15th, 1989. Maria was missing for 5 days before a fisherman urinating off of the South Green Drive bank in Rochester saw a mannequin 40 feet down, he thought. It was naked in the grass and the brush, wearing go-go boots with a blonde wig on. In reality, Frances had been thrown from the bridge and landed against a tree and died down there after having been horrifically raped. From the coroner, she had tattoos, kiss off on buttocks, all in capitals, kiss off on her butt. She had a cross on her ankle, a wing on her shoulder, a butterfly on her wrist. That wing might have been what made him throw her off a bridge, I wonder, eh? With the butterfly on her wrist, you think he can fly? Bitch, as he would say. Right, I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I'm just trying to get into his head a bit there. She was strangled to death, and there was no semen on the scene. This killer is not climaxing, and they're collecting this information as the bodies pile up. Pimps and prostitutes of the area were questioned. Clem Brown, the grandfather to Franny Brown, eventually came in and ID'd his granddaughter. Do you want to hear what Shawcross had to say about this one later? Sure, why wouldn't you? He said he picked her up on Lyell, a street there that's known for this prostitution, obviously. We hear it multiple times. And he brought his victim to the green parking lot, which is near a fishing spot of his. He gave her $30 and told her to get in the back seat and let's do a 69, he said. And then he asked for deep throat as that was happening and then suffocated her in this way. I think I made a joke about him having a small dick earlier, and it's really not the appropriate time to bring that back up. Clearly, I was wrong. So, while still warm, the body, he kissed and sucked and tongued her breasts and wasn't able to achieve orgasm even through this with a dead body, incredibly. And then he rolled her over the cliff like trash. Nasty work. I'm blinking away here. I'm just blinking like crazy like he does it. You can see it in the show notes how much he blinks. I'm just blinking like him. So Kimberly Logan, 30 years old. She disappeared November 15th, 1989. She was found November 15th, same day in 89. A trucker was checking his trailer on Meg Street when he stepped on a hard object under the leaves and snow and found a naked body, face battered, abdomen bruised, leaves stuffed deep in the throat. Kimberly was African-American, an outlier to all the rest of the victims and race, so it seemed unrelated at first to the so-called gorge bodies, they were calling them, until Shawcross later confessed to this crime, and unfortunately I don't have a lot of information on Kimberly. Elizabeth Liz Gibson, 29, disappeared November 25th, 1989. She was found November 27th, 1989. This is all happening in a span of months. Shawcross was having dinner at one of his dumping grounds. That business I mentioned, that restaurant, Mark's on the Lake, he's having dinner there. There's a body behind it of his. After dinner with his girlfriend, he told her to go on home without him because he had spotted a girl in the parking lot that he knew was a prostitute. And she was in a car, in her car. She would go around picking up people in her car to give blowjobs to for money and have sex with, and she could stay warm this way, right? It's, you know what the fuck? It's like a, you're driving around in a car. It's better than standing on the side of the street and being brought into guys' cars. It's actually a pretty good idea. Not tonight, though. So he gets in the car with her and they sit for 20 minutes talking. He's like, I'll give you 10 bucks for like a hand job. And then they make out and he gets aggressive real quick and wants to take the whole thing. He wants to take $100 worth. Liz, she panics, scratches at Art's eyes. She breaks the gear shift in the struggle. He presses his big frame on her until she stops struggling. And then he drives her body out to Wayne County into a snowy field. And then he just dumps her there. He strips her first and brings, he always brings the clothing to the Salvation Army. A charitable gentleman. You imagine wearing some clothes and then finding out it was, those clothes were stripped off of a dead sex worker? Holy fuck. God damn. These are nice boots, but fuck, I guess I'll still wear them. Scratches on his face were noticed by his dopey friends at the Dunkin' Donuts he frequented. Shawcross claimed he had gotten them while chasing a deer. Yeah, that's what we all do. We chase deer into the woods. When you're hunting, you run after deer. gets slapped in the face by a bunch of fucking twigs and berries. So Darlene Trippi, 32, she disappeared December 15th, 1989. She was found January 5th of 1990. She was private, attractive, short curly hair, Caucasian. I need to mention that now that an African-American victim here has just seemingly been thrown away and I don't have a lot of information on her, unfortunately. Darlene turned to the streets and cocaine after her baby's crib death. She worked after dark in the Jones-Emerson area. She was a friend to Joanne, whom we'll meet in a moment. And Joanne urged her to go to safer areas because there was a strangler active in Rochester. She stuck to regulars. As a result, she had been last seen on Lyell Street. Shawcross later led police 20 minutes down back roads, a drive to a small bridge. Darlene was found naked, floating spread eagle, face up, frozen in ice. Shawcross's account, he picked her up on Dewey behind a warehouse. He couldn't get her wrecked. She cursed and called him little boy in baby talk. Little boy, little boy. So he choked her to death. June Cicero, 33, disappeared December 17th, 1989. She was found January 3rd of 1990. She was the toughest and meanest, according to Shawcross. She worked in the windy cold that year. Police who patrolled the area had asked June if she was worried about the strangler, the cold weather, the fact that she was one of the few street workers out there. June laughed. She said, business is up because all those girls are off the streets. She declined a ride home by those cops and they let her continue her sex work. She disappeared. Acquaintances said she only entered known cars, so the killer had to have been familiar to her. Her body was found in a Salmon Creek culvert. Initially, she was thought to be Felicia Stevens. She had a missing pink stone earring that was eventually found in Shawcross's car or that of his girls. Lumalite showed orange specks in that car of Shawcross's girl later, and that was deemed to be, quote, human sawdust. A lot of body rubbing in there, I guess. A gross detail, but they call it human sawdust. And a bunch of human sawdust was found in Shawcross's car along with the missing pink stone earring from June Cicero. The body of June had deep genital cuts to the bone. The killer had returned to the body after having dumped it and attempted to saw out the organs with a hacksaw. From Shawcross's later psychiatric interview, he had taken her clothes to a Salvation Army box, returned days later, cut out her vagina, and ate some of it. My stomach started to gurgle there. That wasn't because I was hungry. Christ, we got one more here. Felicia Stevenson, who I just mentioned, 20 years old. She disappeared December 28th of 1989. She was found December 30th of 89. A prostitute, an addict, 5'5", 115 pounds, black hair, brown skin, brown eyes. She wore double jeans against the cold. She had a white sweatshirt, a black ski cap on, a gold scarf, gray boots. She was walking through deep snow, plying her trade. A guard at Northampton Park found her ice-encrusted jeans in a snowbank. On her, she had her birth certificate and her social security card for ID in case she would be murdered. Nearby, one boot of hers was found, and 100 yards away, another was found, meaning she had been dragged through to the dump spot. This was a return to old stomping grounds, stomping on the heads of fucking prostitute grounds for Shawcross. Her body was found underneath the snow. Felicia's mother hadn't seen her daughter for weeks because of her drug use and prostitution habit. Because her work as a sex worker. And she had last been seen with her janitor boyfriend on December the 26th, Boxing Day. I don't want to make any more jokes. They had argued about her habit in a taxi cab, and that was the last time he'd seen her. Felicia took off often after arguments and went off to make money for drugs. In Shawcross's later interview, he said that at 2 a.m. post-Christmas, Boxing Day, he had stopped at a red light around Plymouth to Maine. He was in a different car than his girlfriend Clara's Omni, the blue Omni that he normally drove. He was driving a loner Celebrity, gray in color. The passenger window was half down when he started talking to her. She stuck her head in, and then he raised the window up and caught her neck in it. And this was real funny to him. He choked her with the window, pulled her in by the hair, and just strangled her through the windows. Some of his best work, he'd let her say. And I'm starting to understand why they never made a movie about this. Shawcross drove the expressway to Northampton Park and dumped the body. Like the Green River killer Gary Ridgway, the Genesee killer Art Shawcross often revisited his dump sites, though visit is a light way of putting it. I mean, he's cutting out the vaginas of his victims on these visits, after probably having re-raped them and eating their vaginas. By late 1989, police had linked the bodies to one killer. On December 31st of 89, Felicia's jeans and boots are found. On January the 3rd of 1990, an aerial search of that area spotted a body in Salmon Creek, the culvert, and that is Felicia. Nearby, a gray Chevrolet Celebrity, that loner that he's in, is spotted with its door open. A man, Shawcross, is seen to be probably urinating on the fucking dump site. So they're what they're doing is they're coming back to these dump sites, realizing the killer is returning, and they found him pissing, or more likely masturbating, over the site. His car takes off when he sees the helicopter. He's followed to the Wedgwood Nursing Home, where his girlfriend Clara worked. And from there, he's brought in for questioning. And in questioning, it's revealed that he has that previous manslaughter charge where two kids were fucking killed by him, raped, murdered. And he denies any involvement with prostitutes at this point. Either like, dude, you were just jerking off or pissing on like the dump site of one of these sex workers. No, man, I would never fucking deal with prostitutes. I'm just taking a piss. Here's a tip about scumbags. If they get incredibly angry when you accuse them of something, they did it. Shawcross is calmed with fishing talk, then released. Caught, catch and release, they're doing here. But later, through photo lineup, sex workers, ID'd Mitch as the John they'd all been suspicious of. Mitch was Shawcross's alias as a John. He wore a jacket from the Salvation Army that had the name Mitch stitched on it. Now, I mentioned Joanne earlier. This is Joanne Van Nostrand, a survivor. She ends up being, she was a friend of one of the victims there I just mentioned. She ended up being the one to ID Shawcross, describing him as a guy who had taken her on a date and then asked her to play dead. And that's the only way he could climax, he said. Shawcross said the reason he let Joanne go was because he could ejaculate with her because she played dead so well. It was the best sex I ever had, he said. Jerking off over a girl pretending to be dead was the best sex he ever had. and he let her go. You win. January 5th of 90, he is arrested. He's cooperative. He doesn't ask for a lawyer. Shawcross is pressured with evidence. The earring that is found in the car. The fucking human sawdust. Being seen at the scene of a crime. Jerking off on it. He confesses to 11 murders. And he sorts through crime scene photos to confess to those 11. He's like, ah, there should be more here. But I mean, yeah, those 11 I did. Yeah, I did that one. I did that one too. Yeah, that's another. Yeah, she was a lot of work. Shawcross just gave up at this point. He's like, fuck, it took you long enough. He went on to give a 79-page stenograph confession. His girlfriend, Clara, vehemently defended him until Shawcross turned to her and said, would you just shut up, bitch? End quote. That wasn't a quote. I said that one. Sorry. Trial started November 1990 in Monroe County. For 11 known murders, Art Shawcross pleaded not guilty by insanity. He said he had brain damage. Well, his defense team did. They said there was a cyst in his temporal lobe. There was frontal scarring on it. This was all true from all the fucking falling off ladders and getting hit in the head with discuses. He has said he had multiple personality disorder, would shift to a character named Bessie when killing. And Bessie, if you recall, was his mom's nickname. He claimed he had PTSD from childhood abuse, and that was what was to blame for all this. Shawcross was convicted of all 11 murders. He received 250 years, life, no parole, which is always funny to me. You put life with no parole on top of 250 years, whatever. I mean, it's just the way the system works. He died November 10th, and he was age 63 years old at that time. It was cardiac arrest that he went down from. Prison life, it turned out, was the one thing for which he didn't have the heart. And I know I lost mine. About 6 or 7 victims in while creating this episode. The work of art. Shawcross. And that'll do it. I was not smoking cigarettes, but now I am again. 2 weeks. I'm going to give myself a day. You want to hear something about my research on this case that disturbed me probably overall the most? Somehow. I watched a YouTube documentary on this case. I think it's called Serial Killer Documentaries or something on YouTube. And it's done by this YouTuber that has like a million subscribers that sounds like AI. And the creator described the rapes by Shawcross on those two little kids in the beginning, Jack and, God damn it, Emily? Oh, fuck, probably forgot the name right. But he described the rape and murder of those two little kids as them having had non-consensual sex as a way to get around the algorithm. You know, they can't say rape, they say grape sometimes. And they say S.A. What's that guy's name? Disturbin, that I watch on YouTube sometimes. Uses S.A. like every fucking killer is Latino. But it's unbelievable to me that they would say that a child had non-consensual sex when they were raped and murdered. For fuck's sake, just bleep it out. Just say rape and bleep it. Fuck. Like, what are we doing here? Framing. Just trying to frame horrific shit like child rape appropriately to make money off of it. I mean, not me, clearly. But anyways, happy holidays, everyone. That always pisses weird Christian people off, too. Let's just piss everyone off. It's Christmas! Say it's Christmas! No. No. I'm saying happy holidays. Deal with it. You say fucking Merry Christmas. I say happy holidays. Go fuck yourself. I've been having fun with that word lately. No. Just say no to people. Try it. Next time someone's dragging you into their bullshit at Christmas dinner or whatever, just go, no. They're going on about like how much they love Trump or how much they hate Trump or something, even though they live in Canada. And then you're just like, no. And they're like, what? No. Like, you know, like he would to a bratty child or a misbehaved dog. So what are your thoughts? No. Anyways, it's the most wonderful time of the year. And all I want for Christmas See, when you're talking directly about Christmas, you say Christmas, but when you're talking to a stranger who might not celebrate Christmas, you say Happy Holidays. Do you go around wishing everyone happy birthday on your fucking birthday? You fucking strong, fucking headed, conservative, acting like the fucking world has to yield to the way in which you see things, piece of shit. Fuck you. Fuck all these assholes. God damn it, I'm sick of everybody. Aren't you sick of everybody? No, I'm not. I'm just screwing around. I really don't care that much about anything except my family and friends and reviews of Dark Topic. All I want for Christmas is for you to sign up to Dark Topic Plus, or at the very least, drop me a rating and review. Dark Topic Plus has fucking over 100 Dark Topic episodes you haven't heard before, but just mention it. You get it free. You can go get it for free. Go steal it if you want. I don't care. Just please listen to the stuff that I've done with myself, my brother, with Chungus. I mean, don't let it rot there. So let's open up a cup. Let me light this cigarette again. Fuck. I might have lit the whole studio on fire when I freaked out about whatever I was freaking out about there. Christmas, I guess. So let's open up like a gift a couple of these reviews that I have received just for kicks here. 5 stars. Just wow. If talent were a crime, Jack Luna would be serving multiple life sentences. Ah, oh, thank you. 5 stars. Another one here. I won't say the names or nothing. One of my favorites. Love his storytelling and how honest he is about his own struggles. It takes a strong person to admit them, or a fucking crazy person. I appreciate your daily effort to just be a decent human. Thank you. I really do. We need more people to put in that effort. I agree. I haven't looked at these for a bit, I gotta tell you. I'll have to sit and read them all. It really does give me a good feeling, though. Thank you so much. There's no real negative stuff here. Oh, wait. There's a 1 star. All right, 1 star. This is the most disgusting true crime podcast I have ever listened to. I had to stop the episode. This podcast is sick and twisted. That's not good. Maybe we should finish up here. Oh, wait. Okay, something down the middle. 3 stars. Good, but not always. Good storytelling, and Jack has a great podcast voice. From Smokin'. 1 sec. It's from Smokin'. Sometimes their narrow-minded opinions about countries and people ruin a good episode, though. Would be good if they just stick to the true crime story rather than their narrow-minded views. Okay, I'll say the name of this. Gunzi from Australia. Okay. Kind of an inappropriate name considering recent events in your country, but thanks for not assuming my pronouns there, Guns. Unless you think I'm an entity. Calling me they maybe means you think I'm more than one person. I'm the only one doing this podcast, by the way. I write it. I have some help with research from my mother-in-law. Shout out, Deb. And I record it. I produce it myself. But there's a lot of confusion here. I'm working on not making sweeping generalizations to play into this a bit here. And I appreciate actually any feedback, truly. I'm just fucking around. Usually I'm just trying to be funny, but I understand there's a lot of hate in the world. And oftentimes when attempting to make such fun, like about Indian people taking baths in lakes in Canada recently and stuff, I'm just screwing around. They are doing that, but I'm not saying every fucking person from India would do that. There is an underlying hate attached to me speaking about that. And honestly, I'm working on it because I'm becoming bothered with some of what you're talking about too, there, Guns. Like the way retard, the word retard is coming back. See the way that I changed the way I said it so that maybe it doesn't get picked up and my advertising doesn't fucking go down the tubes? I'm not sure why people don't understand that using a word that they use in elementary school to insult other kids by comparing them to the disabled is a little inappropriate. You know, most of the disabled end up dying young too, right? Like these are mostly kids that you're talking about when you say retard. Have you ever seen a kid that you saw in class when you were a kid who's kind of like, you know, in a wheelchair and having trouble and shouting out and stuff? The kids that I worked with, have you ever seen an old one of those? And they were taken care of by their parents their whole lives. So those parents had to hear you use that word against someone who is not, you know, quote unquote, retarded and be like, oh, they're using my child to insult that person. Do you get that? I mean, most like me use it on occasion, the word retard, to be inintentionally inappropriate, to be funny, I guess. But I think most people have forgotten how to have proper fun. Maybe even me. Now that I think about it, or they, as, and what do I call myself now? My? Maybe even my. Thank you, Guns. Even though your use of pronouns when it comes to addressing me is a little fucking little ridiculous. See, I'm learning on the fly. Anyways, that was all fun. Well, fuck, it wasn't all. What am I talking about? That was not fun at all. Rate, review, try to resist intentionally giving me a negative review so that I read it out. I fucking will. Give me 5 stars, give me a negative if you got something bad to say about me. How about that? Give me a bunch of 5-star reviews and tell me exactly what you think of me. Please, be honest. I'll read it out. But if you do resist the urge to give me that negative review with a 5-star attached to it, I appreciate you, and we get each other more than you might know. And I hope instead that you overcome your urge to not sign up for more Dark Topic on Dark Topic Plus. Links in the show notes. Probably 100 or way more, like I said, Dark Topic Plus offerings available there. I was going to say 67 or so, but let's keep it evergreen. That's dying. 6, 7, 6. You know how you kill the fun the kids have with things like 6, 7? I don't get it. Yeah, no shit, you don't get it. You're not supposed to get it, you fucking idiot. The way you kill that fun for those kids is to join in on it as an adult like I'm doing right now. And I suddenly want to say something about my father. I mean, I already did, and my grandfather. My dad was excellent with kids. Excellent. Because I guess he was one the whole time. And I miss him. I miss him now that he's gone. And if you're listening, Dad, somehow, some way, I miss you. Holidays are tough on stuff like that. Anyways, know that just for listening, you're all 5 stars in my book. My book, I'm working on it. It's actually about my dad. It's called Loon. And you'll see it next year, or read it if you want to. And speaking of book, I got some recommended reading, Swan Song by Robert R. McCammon. I'd say it's McCammon's version of King's The Stand. McCammon wrote Boy's Life. That might be the only one you're familiar with. But Swan Song by Robert R. McCammon, it's phenomenal. McCammon doesn't get the shine he deserves, I feel. I'll convince you of that if you want to see something in the show notes. He looks just like my dad. And, or how my dad did before he died. And McCammon has a message for any of us who should want to write. It's in the show notes. So I read Robert R. McCammon. I listened to him now. I'm listening to Swan Song on Audible, which is not a fucking sponsored thing of Dark Topic for some reason yet. BetterHelp has been trying to rip me off and get me to sponsor them again. And I think I'll do one, but probably only one. I hope Audible reaches out because I listen to a lot of Audible. But when I was a teenager, I remember reading a lot of Robert R. McCammon, because my stepfather read a lot of books. He worked at General Motors in Oshawa, Ontario, and he always had a paperback in his coveralls. And he actually got me into reading, my stepfather, and I plan on thanking him for that someday. But I got a copy of Usher's Passing, and I read it throughout the whole winter that we spent at his cottage. And I'm coming home because I would be in the back of the truck. It was like a cab on a truck, and with the two dogs, Sheba and Minnie, I think at the time were the two dogs. And we had a bunch of blankets back there. And then my brother and my mom and my stepfather were driving up front, and I'd be in the back. And it was cold back there, but I had a lot of blankets. And it's a 3-hour drive, and I'm finishing up Usher's Passing. But as we started to come into the city and got back home, I knew I couldn't finish the book. I just didn't have enough time to finish it. And I knew I wouldn't, because the real world was coming for me again as like a 14-year-old kid. I just knew I wasn't going to be able to finish it. And it always bugged me. And I recently just finished that book myself. I bought Usher's Passing by Robert R. McCammon and finished it. It was like really cathartic, I guess. And anyways, stay the course if you can. If you're a kid for some reason listening to this, go read. Go find yourself a corner and read and relate and get off the social media as much as you can. I know that you're supposed to be on there. You have to be to connect with your friends and all that, but be different. go out there and read. None of my friends were reading, and I think it made me the person that I am today. If you're a parent listening, I mean, for Christmas, it's a little late, but I'd say get them a book. Get them a book and pay them to read three chapters a night. I'll give you $5 if you read a chapter. I mean, whatever it takes to get these kids to read. Reading, I know most of you who read know this, but what it does is it takes you away from that phone, first of all, on the screens, but it puts you into another person's perspective, that being the writer, but it puts you into characters and it allows you to live through their lives in your mind, and it opens your mind in ways in which you couldn't open on your own through regular life, because regular life isn't as magical as the tales that are woven and the actions and the places and the circumstances in which characters are put in by authors like Robert R. McCammon. All right. Anyways, stay the course, and until next time, keep those eyes cocked, those doors locked, stay paranoid. Happy holidays, everybody. I'll see you real soon. Big love.
Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.